Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we're going to have a wonderful guest for you, a longtime guest, one of the leading editors in the United States to talk about the state of journalism and politics in the world today. So join us today for Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Now that the $7.2 billion broadband stimulus package has been passed by Congress, it's up to government agencies to fund projects that will bring high-speed internet and data services to unserved and underserved areas. One of the first tasks is to figure out where broadband is available. The stimulus package includes $350 million for broadband mapping. Public interest groups want the mapping process to be conducted by a government agency, but industry lobbyists are aggressively pushing to privatize the mapping process. Art Brodsky of Public Knowledge says that would give the phone and cable companies too much power.
And those companies have it within their power to decide which data gets reported, how it gets reported, who can see it and who can't see it. Their modus operandi up until now has been to sign very restrictive non-disclosure agreements with states and basically take control of the mapping process. And what we see is a conflict of interest of basically privatizing the mapping function.
Public Knowledge, Common Cause, the Media and Democracy Coalition, and Reclaim the Media issued a report last week called Privatizing the Public Trust. It criticizes the most well-known mapping organization, Connected Nation, which is funded by telephone and cable companies. Connected Nation's maps don't differentiate between broadband service types like DSL, cable, or fiber, and all the data collected remains the property of AT&T. But despite these substantial flaws, Connected Nation is getting a lot of attention from policymakers.
The problem is that in many states, Connected Nation or like affiliates are totally wired in, if you forgive the expression, to the process, basically through their patrons and the phone and cable companies. In Minnesota, for example, the legislature directly appropriated money to them to do mapping, going around every established other group in the state.
Brodsky is concerned that Connected Nation's deep corporate ties will influence the federal mapping process, as it has in some states.
It's incumbent upon activists to be on the lookout for these kind of awards, for these kind of proceedings, and intervene, having companies take control of the data for their own advantage so that it's not transparent to the public, it's not verifiable, it's not granular, it's not accurate, it's not accountable, is a bad way to go and a terrible waste of money, and we're trying to prevent that.
Say the word Madagascar, and most Americans will think of the animated movie about cute zoo animals. But the actual island nation of Madagascar, off the African coast, has been in turmoil. A power struggle has resulted in the ouster of the country's president. More than 160 people have been killed this year, and protests are escalating. But there's been little news of the situation in the mainstream U.S. media. Luva Rakotomalala, a native of Madagascar, is a research associate at Purdue University. He's been blogging at globalvoicesonline.org for a couple of years. He noticed an uptick in messages on Twitter, the social networking site, from people in Madagascar last month when the violence increased. Twitter limits messages to 140 characters, which makes it perfect for transmitting small bits of information by cell phone. Rakotomalala quickly realized the potential of this new technology to distribute news from his homeland. He says that Twitter was appealing because it's quick, it can be sent with a phone, and it's mobile.
One of the problems, I think, was that the local journalists were all located in one location. Usually it's downtown of the capital city, and a lot of the unrest and turmoil were in different regions, and there was no way they could really get any real information about what was going on over there. So it was important, I think, that if someone was there, that they could rapidly send some information via cell phone, and then we would put it on Twitter, and then we could say where he is, and then they would verify if someone else is there. And then we would have a more accurate picture of how much turmoil is really going on.
Rakoto Malala creates blog posts from the Twitter messages. The accounts, which include pictures and videos, have caught the attention of the Wall Street Journal, the BBC, and Al Jazeera. But Rakoto Malala is quick to point out that neither he nor the members of the Twittering group are journalists. They're simply concerned about what's happening in Madagascar and want to get the word out.
Global Voices helped us with an outreach program. They helped us start a project that would help people who are not very familiar with new media start blogging and start Twittering.
There is concern for the safety of the members of the group, particularly since a journalist in Madagascar was killed in February. Some Twitterers have been intimidated at gunpoint and told to delete photos from their cameras, but they're still out there gathering information.
It is a concern, but the only thing we can do is advise them to stay away from where the violence is really taking place and just try to report from far.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is the editor of The Nation magazine, a frequent guest here on the airwaves of WILL, and it's an honor to welcome back Katrina VandenHeuvel.
Thank you, Bob. Honor to be on your program.
Well, it's great to have you here. And first of all, before we get started, Katrina, a little bit about The Nation, the magazine you edit. You've been editing it now, gosh, 15 years?
Almost 15. It's 144 years old, and some mornings I feel about 144. No, it's an honor to edit The Nation. It's the oldest continuously published weekly in the United States. But what's been exciting in these last years, couple years particularly, is that we're getting our ideas and our information, our reporting, across many platforms. And it's not a term I love, but, you know, we're using the Internet. We're using video. And, of course, we're using the pages of the magazine. But we're reaching, you know, maybe 2 million people a month, maybe more, and not only in this country but around the world. One thing I'm particularly proud of, I have to say, and I don't want to gloat, but it makes me feel that The Nation, as it has been over these last 144 years, has acted as an early warning system. I mean that in the sense of this economic crisis. The Nation also has a book imprint with Basic Books, and we published a collection of our coverage of the economy and the financial system in a book called Meltdown: How Greed and Corruption Shattered Our Financial System and How We Can Recover. And in that book, what it showed me is that if you're not bound by the orthodoxies of convention, when too many had as their mantra, don't worry, be happy, The Nation, as I said, like an early warning system, alerted us 10, 15 years ago to the dangers of this deregulatory frenzy, the predatory lending dangers, the rising economic inequality, and these bubbles, these speculative bubbles that are, a blight in our economic system. So I think that there's a sense that at times of crisis, The Nation not only can go back and look at what went wrong, and history matters, but also with our ideas, we've laid down markers as to how we can craft a people's recovery and how we can move forward. And finally, you know, you feel this too, Bob, I think, though the country has not shifted as far in a direction as we might like, there is a real shift that this crisis has moved forward. I mean, you know, discredited ideas, market fundamentalism no longer the ruling ethos, and ideas and proposals that the magazine has championed for years, re-regulation, reining in executive pay, and a more equitable and greener economy, a more active government, are on the agenda, and are on the agenda in ways that we understand we need to, you know, mobilize in terms of our reporting and our activism the Internet to drive in sharper directions, but they're there to be pushed. So it's a new time, and though the pain in this country is painful to witness, you know, the story in the New York Times yesterday, finally, about 10 cities across this nation, that there is a belief that out of crisis comes opportunity, and that, you know, it's better than what they used to call in the former Soviet Union stagnation, which I think that did afflict our system for too long.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, you know, you referred to The Nation's anticipation and coverage of the financial problems long before it became a crisis that everyone was experiencing directly. what role do you think that the mainstream news media have played in failing to do that? I mean, what is their responsibility in the newsrooms of America that until last year they were pretty much, as far as I can tell, not only asleep at the switch, almost cheering on the process?
Yeah, I mean, you're a far more astute media critic than I am, Bob. But I mean, it's clear that, you know, there was the mainstream media remained mired in the conventional wisdom about, as I said earlier, sort of that markets can do no wrong, and that they, you know, part of it is a class phenomenon in many of the newsrooms. Though, you know, let's be honest, we're in a kind of schizophrenic moment where we are criticizing some of the newsrooms which are disappearing because of different crises, which you and John Nichols so carefully outlined in the pages from the cover story of The Nation a couple weeks ago. But, you know, that there was a conventional wisdom that didn't allow reporters to look beyond this idea, as I said earlier, that the markets can do no wrong. And there is a continuing obsession, even today, Bob, with the stock market as a measure of our economic well-being. This drives me berserk. There is a continuing obsession, as your listeners may have noted, at the Obama press conference, his second one. The first tier of questions from the mainstream media, I believe they were mostly broadcast media.
Yeah, almost entirely.
Yeah, suggested that these guys, there was one woman from the AP, I guess, were in a time warp. I mean, it's as if the danger of national debt was far greater than the danger of the radical public investment deficit, which is part of what we're witnessing today, the years of failing to invest in this country's infrastructure and its education and healthcare. Anyway, there was one question finally, you know, sort of I clocked it, I think it was 8:44, when a reporter from Ebony, the African-American publication, asked about homeless children and tent cities. And there was a sense of, hey, yeah, there's kind of something else going on in this country. Anyway, I think that we are not yet at a point where we are going to see media, conventional media, mainstream media, shake off some of these frameworks. They've been forced to shake off some because it's in their face in a way that's hard to ignore. But there's still some ongoing dogmas that are inadequate to the stormy times we're living through, to paraphrase great President Lincoln.
Our guest today, Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor of The Nation magazine, coming to you on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580. We pre-recorded this show roughly a week or so before going on air, so please don't call in today. Sit back, relax, and let us do the talking. Katrina, in The Nation, I mean, the coverage of the economy has been, I think, a central issue now for quite some time. And The Nation finds itself, I think, with regard to the Obama administration, sort of a different position than it had, say, with the Bush administration, where I've had you on the show several times in the last 5 or 6 years. And I think it's fair to say that The Nation was pretty much categorically hostile towards the Bush administration's approach to governance.
I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, fair to say. I don't think that's not the relationship with the Obama administration. Yet, at the same time, you're quite critical of the Obama administration, both in foreign policy, but especially right now for our conversation, economic policy. Sort of explain, you know, how you navigate this new relationship when you shift from a Republican to a Democratic president, one you supported, but then when you have severe disagreements on fundamental issues with that president.
Well, I want to begin. It's a very good question. We have certainly moved from a position of sort of outright opposition to one I would call, and I wrote about this in one of my blogs, Editor's Cut, at the end of last year. You know, I think we need to be as pragmatic and clear-eyed about President Obama as he is about us, the progressive independent community. And as the editor of an independent magazine, I think it's important that we call it like we see it, informed by the principles and issues that have been important to us. I think it's also important to be open-minded. And I think in President Obama, you do have someone who, as your listeners know, was a community organizer, which is one of the central reasons we as a nation found his candidacy of great importance and promise. And I think that, you know, my sense of how change has come about in this country, change, a word we heard maybe too much about during the campaign in different ways, come about when citizens, mobilized movements, independent people take into their hands to organize for change they believe in, and allied with a president, with an administration, open-minded to those changes and aware that conditions may drive an administration, a president, beyond his or her own politics. I think we're in that mode. So I think it's important that we continue to push the ideas into the debate. And I think we did that in 2006, Bob. I mean, I think there was a shift there prior to Obama's Democratic president's victory, where we saw, you know, ending the war in Iraq, a new trade policy, different stance toward health care, a different thinking about the economy, a more populist, in the best sense of that term, a view of the economy. We drove those issues into the debate, I would argue. So today, here's my concern, and I wrote about it the day after his press conference. My concern is I think Obama has, in terms of his stimulus, with its flaws, that's a very important break with 30 years of, I would argue, misrule, mostly Republican with Democratic complicity, a failure to use public investment wisely. I think the stimulus, I see it as a down payment. That's going to require citizen mobilization to drive that into a second, third stimulus, and I think we're going to need it if you look at these job numbers.
Mm-hmm.
The bank bailout, that is where I think you see the limits of the Obama administration's link to a Wall Street mentality, where they're essentially, you know, kind of subsidizing these private players, hedge funds and private equity, to play the game. And, you know, you've got an administration's team marinated in Wall Street, and they're going to socialize losses and privatize profits, I fear. So the hope is Obama's good judgment understands he may need a plan B if that fails. And then finally on the housing piece of it, I think, you know, if you give a grade to this administration, it's a B. They didn't move quickly enough, but they're moving now. And I think, you know, we need to assess that. The danger, Bob, is I worry that in the populism, and there's certainly a right-wing kind of faux populism afoot in the land, that there is a conflation of this bank bailout and anger at bankers, and the righteous anger it is, that may harm the ability to pull through and push through the right level of public investment and pump it into the economy that so desperately needs it. My last point is partly because this administration is still tied to a kind of Wall Street old order. Though you have someone like a Jared Bernstein, who your listeners may know is a good progressive economist, wrote a very good book, Crunch, about how ordinary people are hurt by the market. He's not only Vice President Biden's chief economic advisor, but he's playing a role with Obama, too. But my point is, we need not only to restore the old order, we need to build a new finance and economic sector, one that is closer to the people, one that is more democratic, more decentralized. And the danger is that there seems at the moment, just maybe because of the crisis facing us, just a restoration. And we need to push beyond so that it's not just new regulation, tighter regulation, but a new kind of finance and economic sector that is not one that created these so-called toxic assets that are afflicting the economy and people.
You know, Kevin Phillips, the writer, who's in his recent book Bad Money, argued that over the past couple of decades, finance capital, as it's become ascendant in the political economy of the United States and dominant, really, has done a very good job of pretty much taking over the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party, that it, you know, bankrolls both parties. And so if someone had read Phillips' book, they would not be surprised by Obama's choice of Summers or Geithner or the other people to run his economic policy. Is it because
on the other hand, I can't believe I'm going to make a case for Larry Summers here, but I mean, Larry Summers of today is not Larry Summers of 1993.
Mm-hmm.
But this is where we see the limits. This is where our work is to not only restore the economy with the shadow banking and all of the dangers of that, but to build on this new foundation a new economy out of the ashes of the old. And that, I think, is where, you know, Larry Summers may now understand the dangers of rising inequality, may understand the need to pump money into the economy, but it's the long haul of rebuilding a new economy that is going to require the work of, you know, people like Kevin Phillips, people like William Grider, who has a terrific mm-hmm. book out called Come Home America, going to be talking to Bill Moyers in these next days. So he really lays out what a new foundation, a more democratic economy could look like. And I think, you know, that's an important task for places like The Nation, for progressives, for people who care about a return to a more humane form of living need to focus on.
Our guest, Katrina VandenHeul, editor of The Nation. I'm Bob McChesney at WILL AM 580. This is Media Matters. Please don't call in today. We recorded this show roughly a week or so before going on air, so let editor VandenHeul and myself do the yakking today. In the debates over the economy, one of the more conspicuous parties has been aspects of the debate has been watching the Republican Party deal with coming up with a critique and alternatives. And I'm still having difficulty fully getting my head around that position.
Really? I'm shocked. I'm shocked because it's really not hard. I mean, you just kind of give it an eyeball view, and you can see that you're really dealing with people in denial. I mean, you have. I don't mean to be snarky, but you know, you got a Republican Party, and again, we talked earlier about. You know, there was Democratic complicity. I would argue that the Republicans have led the way in the deregulatory frenzy, but there is no question, as you said, that finance capital has occupied the Democratic Party to such an extent that Summers and Rubin presided over the repeal of one of the central protective elements for consumers and taxpayers, the Glass-Steagall regulations. But the Republicans are in denial. I mean, they're back to, I saw today, Eric Cantor the other day, I saw Bob was at a Britney Spears concert trying to fundraise, which was an interesting new device. But they have, their new plan is basically cut spending except on defense and cut income taxes. And, you know, it's like no new ideas, no solutions. And what strikes me is no shame, but I do think it's going to be a fight because the Republicans are clever. And they are not, you know, they're probably less of a problem in terms of moving Obama's budget, as it should be, without too much trimming. The greater danger, as you may follow, are these so-called blue dog Democrats and this kind of centrist, responsible thinking that spending is out of control. And, you know, I'm no economist, Bob, but what has struck me is, what has struck me is the hunger for an interest in the economy at this point. And The Nation is planning to do a series of teach-ins around the country. We did one in New York at the beginning of March. We had to turn away 1,000 people.
Wow.
But we want to go to Detroit. We want to go to places in this country which are really being hit hard. But I would say that this is a time for spending and that the notion that we may go bankrupt, which the Republicans like to trot out, is pretty ridiculous because we can sustain a higher rate of spending, of debt, if it's invested in smart ways, not in fighting unnecessary wars which make us less secure, tax cuts for the rich, but in infrastructure, energy alternatives. And we need to. And it will still be a smaller percentage of GDP to our economy than it is in Europe. Now, that may be heretical to say, not only for Republicans who think the French are deep socialists, but for maybe some of these Democrats, but it is worth saying that as Western industrialized nations go, this country can do a hell of a lot better by its citizens.
You know, Representative Paul Ryan has become the point person for the Republican Party in many respects in providing an alternative budget, making a critique of the Obama stimulus plan. A centerpiece of his argument and the Republican argument is that the New Deal has been overrated, that the New Deal of the 1930s actually did not cure or solve the Depression. And so similar stimulus policies today will not solve the Depression. It's an interesting argument because, as I heard in an interview with Ryan last week, he went on to say that what solved the Depression was World War II, and that did the
job. It's an argument, you know, it's an argument, Bob, that not only Ryan, but this woman, Amity Schles, who's ensconced over at this place, the Council on Foreign Relations, peddles hard.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, listen, William Grider wrote a terrific cover story for The Nation God, about 10 years ago. What's so interesting is that the right has invested an enormous amount of time in trying to discredit the New Deal because it was a viable model, and it's a touchstone for progressives with all its flaws, but they want to roll it back. And that's, you know, if they've rolled back the Glass-Steagall legislation I talked about earlier, if we didn't have the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, we would see scenes that we saw in the 30s and that I've gone back and read in the pages of The Nation of people milling around banks desperate for their money because they are fearful mm-hmm. of being plunged into poverty. So we have a buffer, which may be one reason we haven't seen more outrage in the streets. But I think they're wrong on this. I think what the major mistake of the Roosevelt administration was in 37 or 38, due to political pressure, Roosevelt reverted to what he was when he came into office, which was more of a moderate deficit reduction Democrat. And it was that mistake that then pivoted the New Deal off course because it was creating jobs and it moved unemployment from, I think it was 25%, Bob, when Roosevelt mm-hmm. came in, to, you know, something more like 8 or 9, I may be wrong, but the key point is that there was great progress that Roosevelt, and a lesson for Obama to look at, made a mistake by moving back to a deficit reduction program, and that domestic spending is vital. The most dangerous deficit, as I think I said earlier, is our public investment deficit, and don't repeat Roosevelt's mistake of trying to balance budgets too quickly, driving the economy back into a bad position as he did in 37. The role of World War II is, of course, it's a large question. I mean, I do think it's worth reminding some of these, I hate to call them conservatives because I think they're not that in a classical sense.
They're more like Hooverites.
They're more like Hooverites, but, you know, that you're right, neo-Hooverites. But, you know, our GDP coming out of World War II was as much as 109%. The current U.S. public debt is about 40% of mm-hmm. our GDP. So, again, I come back to that point that we could spend without all this danger of bankruptcy and hyperinflation that too many are speaking of too quickly.
You know, Katrina, because I'm doing this interview over the telephone, you can see my eyebrows curling with sarcasm as I ask that question, because I think that Schlaes and Paul Ryan had unintended irony, because World War II is nothing but Keynesianism exponentially increased.
That's right.
I mean,
That's right.
The argument they're making actually is you need to go significantly further than anything FDR or Obama had ever imagined to successfully tame stagnation and depression.
Yeah.
Our guest.
But that fight, it is interesting, and this is where history matters, Bob. That fight goes on. The fight about did the New Deal work or not, because people, you know, understand that it is, as I said, a touchstone in our history when there was a different course, and we are now, you know, whether this is a new deal, the world has changed in many ways, but we are at a moment where we need alternatives in our history to remind us of what was possible before decades of conservative misrule or decades of market fundamentalism took us off course. So that I think is mm-hmm. is important.
You know, I want to go back to one point you made, because I think it's very important a few minutes ago regarding the mainstream news media and the press conference that President Obama had last week that was televised. And it seems, and you were touching on this, that there's sort of a disconnect between the questions of the mainstream news media, the Washington Press Corps that gets the punditocracy, so to speak, on television, and sort of the issues that people in this country really care about and the perspective they have. And you know, I sometimes wonder as I look at the Obama administration how much the mainstream news media and the Washington Press Corps are sort of a barrier to their really pursuing more progressive policies, because they're sort of in fear that these people will chastise them.
I think, well, it is striking that amidst all the changes that the Washington Press Corps, the Sunday chat shows, which I am complicit in sometimes, so I try to bring a different point of view, of course, but that they've remained so barren of new thinking, new frames. But we started, I want to mention, tell your listeners about this, working with Ari Melber, who is our Netroots movement correspondent. The Nation, along with a cross-partisan coalition, including the Washington Times, Personal Democracy Forum, Change.org, Democrats.com, Larry Lessig, and Hugh Hewitt, a right-wing blogger. But we started something called Ask the President, which is taking up this administration on its promise that it will be the most open and transparent and engaged with citizens. And we're trying to push participatory bottom-up journalism and citizen engagement by asking people to come to communitycounts.com and submit a question, either written or by video, and then site visitors vote on the questions, with the most popular rising to the top. We did this before, not our own project, but the question of Bush accountability rose to the top. Now, you'll see that in these last days, the Obama administration very quickly has set up its own version of this. Hmm. And the other day, Obama met with citizens and took the top question on the administration's own version of this site. And interestingly, it was about legalization of marijuana as a way out of the crisis, because if the government legalized marijuana, it could regulate and tax it. Now, the top question on our site on the eve of the second press conference, in my mind, was very smart, was why are we pouring billions into these irresponsible banks, giving it to irresponsible bankers who took us into this mess, when we might do debt forgiveness for students, forgive loans so that you get some money into their pockets, which might then be pumped back into the economy. That may have been a function of the demographics of the site, that it was a student-oriented question, but I think it shows a savvy because it speaks to a stimulus that is real.
And I think also, Katrina, what you're earlier, the press corps doesn't think in those terms. They think like people standing at the top of the pyramid.
Absolutely.
And in those terms of people who have six and seven figure incomes and how policies will affect them, not the 95% of the people or 97% who don't qualify for those economic conditions.
But I do think the Obama administration is savvy enough, and there's a danger here too of just doing niche journalism, but that they, you know, that the first press conference, there was a hullabaloo about Obama asking a blogger from the Huffington Post. You know, that's great, but I think it's going to take more than that to change the nature of press conferences. But in this last one, I think it was interesting that he did go to, I believe it was Ebony. Mm-hmm. He went to Univision, and he went to the Latino station, and he went to Stars and Stripes, mm-hmm. the Army newspaper. And again, I come back to the Ebony question. I thought, gave a sense of how you could open up the press conference to a different kind of question than the ones we tend to hear too often.
Our guest, Katrina Vandenhul, editor of The Nation magazine. Also, we should hasten to point out, thenation.com, a website that gets, I don't know, it must be one of the biggest, most trafficked websites.
We're doing well. We're doing about, as I said, we're reaching about 2 million people a month. I enjoy it. I think the web is an exciting instrument. I mean, I know you and John and your great cover story for us on the life and death and prospects for newspapers understand the limits of the Internet, and I think we need to be realistic about those limits. I'm not an evangelist for the Internet setting us free. On the other hand, it allows the nation to get its ideas, not just what's in the magazine, but projects like the one I just mentioned, Ask the President, or blogs and proposals out there in new ways.
And I should mention again, this is a pre-recorded show. We taped this about a week or so before going on air, so please don't call in today. Sit back and relax. Katrina, one of the issues you've been working on personally and that the magazine's been writing about at some length, and I think it's going to be writing a lot more about, is the whole question of Afghanistan. This has been presented by Obama during the campaign and now as president as the good war, as opposed to Iraq. This was the just war. And he has made, just last week, a commitment to send more troops to Afghanistan. A previous guest in the show, I think to be accurate, have been somewhat skeptical towards Obama's approach to Afghanistan, although not entirely hostile. What's your take on it?
My take is it's like watching a train wreck develop in slow motion. I mean, if you want Obama's presidency to succeed and to think of all the hopeful things, the good things he is trying to accomplish just domestically, it's hard not to think of how Vietnam derailed Johnson's great society. I mean, I think we're, you know, again, I hate to draw tight parallels, but I think that the escalation of Afghanistan has may bleed us of the resources we need for economic recovery, further destabilize Pakistan, and open a rift with our European allies and negate the positive images of withdrawing from Iraq, however slowly we may be doing that on our image in the Muslim world. I think there's a better way. The Nation has now, every week, we have an editorial in our pages or on our website trying to lay out alternatives, non-military alternatives, to stabilizing Afghanistan and understanding, just security-wise, that what we may well be doing is destabilizing Pakistan by these by this occupation. So I think we need a regional diplomatic strategy. I was just in Moscow, Bob, and mm-hmm. I think, you know, it's painful to watch this escalation of U.S. forces from there. I was in Moscow in 1985 mm-hmm. when the last Soviet troops withdrew from Iraq, from Afghanistan. And I think there's a sense in Moscow of, you know, what someone called Afghanistan the graveyard of empires.
That's right.
You know, the Brits got lost in the quagmire. The Soviet Union did.
Didn't Alexander the Great even have some trouble there?
Your history is better than mine. I don't go back that far. I think we need regional diplomacy. And it is, you know, the one hopeful sign, though it's diminished by this escalation, is that the Obama administration understands the need for regional diplomacy. There is a conference with Secretary of State Clinton bringing together not only India and Pakistan and Russia, but also Iran. And that's where we need to put the effort, because it's unwinnable militarily. And I think we need a regional solution. And I just feel that, you know, it's during the campaign, as you said, it was Obama talking about getting out of Iraq so we could fight the right war. That is a campaign promise I hope he understands that he needs to rethink, because the last point I'd make is it's not 2001 anymore. The region is different. The problem is different. And that the targeted idea of making sure Afghanistan is not a haven for terrorist attacks in the region or on us can be accomplished without military escalation.
You know, it's moving a bit west of there to Israel and Palestine. This, of course, is a central issue in the pages of the Nation. It's really probably one of the great political issues in the globe, has been, and is more so today than ever before. Is there a consensus position of the Nation, or what's the range of debate of the Nation on the whole question of Israel and Palestine?
You know, I would say that I don't know if there's a consensus. Yeah, there's a consensus position that in order to have if you want a secure Israel, we need to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict by freezing the settlements, by bringing together Israelis and Palestinians. That's tough because, as you know, Netanyahu comes to power with Labor and his coalition, and the Palestinian community is torn between Fatah and Hamas. These are very difficult issues. But I do think what has been understood all along is that this is a political problem. Military means are not going to resolve these long, festering conflicts. We need a new, more sane path in pursuit of peace. And it is welcome, despite the fact that we continue to see the power of a right-wing Israeli lobby, I would argue, in this country. You know, the Charles Freeman appointment and how that was pulled
off the
table.
Yeah, and for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with the Charles Freeman case, just explain that if you would, Katrina Vandenhoven.
Well, he was, you know, he's a member of the foreign policy establishment. He was an ambassador to Saudi Arabia, wasn't he, Bob? I mean, he's someone mm-hmm. who spoke, if I could, you know, he spoke in a critical-minded way about the impact a kind of AIPAC, which is a more right-wing Israeli Jewish American lobby group in this country, the impact of the right wing dominating our political debates and policy approaches to the Middle East. And for that, and you know, there were other issues, but boy, the neocon mobilization was pretty quick and fierce, as were, you know, some liberal commentators and bloggers who just felt that these views could not be tolerated in the spectrum of our foreign policy community. To me, putting aside the fact that this was about probably one of the most taboo, difficult issues for people to discuss, it showed the limits of political pluralism, of political debate, of dissenting points of view. But, you know, it is hopeful. For example, your listeners may want to check out a new group called J Street. This, you know, it's a group a new lobby organization that aims to end the right-wing monopoly and give voice to the substantial number of Jewish and non-Jewish Americans with more moderate views on how to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And they already have brought on a number of people in Congress to speak in a more balanced way. The balance is important, Bob, because I think we can't be a one-note country in terms of how to think about that region. I do think George Mitchell, your listeners may remember that he was very central to the resolution of another painful, bloody crisis, the Northern Ireland crisis, is hopeful. It could have been someone else, though there will be people vying to control U.S. policy toward Israel and Iran, people like Dennis Ross, who's also in the administration. But George Mitchell is a fair man.
Do you think, and I don't want to go too much further on this because there's a lot of other ground to cover, but do you think, Katrina VandenHeuvel, that we're at a point now where, for the first time possibly in a long, long time, our lifetimes even, we might be in a situation where we could have a genuine peace between the Israelis and Palestinians that would hold and that would sort of be the basis of sort of a peaceful development of the region?
I don't know. I think what Obama said the other night in a very low-key way was the situation now is unsustainable, the status mm-hmm. quo. I think so much depends on political will, on the ability of the Israeli government to take steps and chances, and my faith is limited in that. And also, as I said earlier, the Palestinian community is very divided, and that is we have an article coming on that, someone who's a longtime watcher of the region. So it's hard to tell, Bob, and I think, it seems like a U.S. leadership role would be important. The Bush administration is often castigated, as it should be in the foreign policy front, but castigated for neglecting to try and address the need for U.S. role and bringing together an Israeli-Palestinian peace process. On the other hand, I think they did play a role, the Bush administration, a negative role. I mean, the U.S. can play a negative role if it comes into a region and basically gives a green light to Israel to continue expanding settlements. So those who follow the region, Bob, my last point, know that after thousands of hours of policy proposals, of conferences, of negotiations, there is a way. There is a proposal that has been on tables for many years, but it's the political will.
For the last decade or so, Katrina VandenHeuvel, switching gears here, in international studies, they've talked about the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, as the four emerging great economic powers of the 21st century that will be the sort of the main challenge to the old regime. And you are an expert in Russia. You speak Russian. You've lived there. You've visited there many times. You've studied it. So you know Russia about as well as anyone we've ever had on the program.
Oh, I don't know.
Well, on the program, that's like being the tallest mountain in Denmark, yeah.
Okay.
In terms of Russia expertise. But at any rate, you've seen Russia from when it was a communist country through the great transition it's gone through. And we've spoken about this a little bit in the air, but given the importance that it will have and is having in the world today, what has been going on in Russia the last 10 or so years? And then where does it stand today? Because the one last comment I'll make is that, we see that the economic crisis, the global crisis, seems to be particularly disastrous in Eastern Europe. And Russia, of course, is the heart of Eastern Europe.
I think the very, very big, important question. I've been going to Russia for 30 years. The last 10 years, 15 years, as you know, Bob, under Yeltsin, Boris Yeltsin, there was a massive, perhaps the greatest 20th century fire sale of the state's assets, its minerals, its oils, to a small group called the oligarchs, who have been on the Forbes billionaire list for many years now. Their assets have plunged because of the fall of oil and gas and commodity prices. They are now, interestingly and ironically, coming back to the state, the Putin-Medvedev government, for assistance. So it's kind of a reverse of what was called loans for shares. They're seeking government funding because they are hyper-leveraged and in debt in ways they can't sustain alone. The larger point, though, is you have a new president, this man, Sergei Medvedev. He's going to meet with Obama first few days of April. Medvedev is younger than Obama. He's 44. He's also a lawyer. There is a view in Moscow that he's trying to carve out his own not only identity, but more important, new coalitions and new allies. You know, Putin, we saw during the Russia-Georgia war, is very much in the saddle in that sense and seems to dominate. On the other hand, Medvedev has been meeting with newspaper editors. One of my good friends there is the editor of the leading opposition newspaper, Novaya Gazeta. Former Russian President Gorbachev is a part owner, and he and the editor of Novaya Gazeta met with Medvedev for an hour a few weeks ago after the killing of a human rights lawyer and a journalist by neo-Nazi groups. And Medvedev said something after the meeting that this opposition newspaper was not one he agreed with, but it was in Russian, a Nuzhnaya Gazeta, meaning a necessary paper, giving it cover and protection in many ways. But it is a kind of managed democracy at best, authoritarian. The parliament has been eviscerated as an independent force, and I think you need a strong checks and balances. And finally, the economic crisis. If you think Detroit is bad, and it is, Russia is filled with what are called monogorods. These are kind of single factory towns built during the Soviet period that are dying. And the stimulus plan in Russia is inadequate to the task. They are trying to pump some money in. They had a reserve fund of, I think, $600 billion, which has been quickly depleted because of the fall in oil prices. And on the foreign policy front, I think, you know, the U.S. has treated Russia as a junior partner at best for too many years. That needs to change. The term now is reset the relationship. The translation Hillary Clinton brought to the foreign minister wasn't very good. The foreign minister who I saw in Moscow says at least now the United States is listening. There is a lack of triumphalism in the U.S.'s part, which, you know, how could there not be after this financial crisis? And if there can be some agreements on arms control, ending this missile defense system, which is folly, freezing the expansion of NATO, and engaging constructively on a number of issues, which, you know, you need to do, I think, if you want to have some serious stability in the world, you know, whether on nuclear proliferation, engaging Iran constructively together. So all of those things are on the agenda when President Obama meets Medvedev, and will be for many months.
You know, Katrina Vandenhoeven, going back to the economy, though, during this period when the oil and gas prices were so high and these great fortunes were made in Russia, and relatively its standard of living was increasing, its economy was growing, I mean, was there any industrialization going on? Was there anything else going on in the economy that can sustain it? Is there a future path for the economy beyond natural resources?
Great failure of this administration in Russia by virtue of allowing the looting of the state by these private oligarchs who make our banksters, if I might call them that, you know, seem pretty responsible. The offshoring of assets, the money pouring into private Swiss bank accounts, the failure of the oligarchs to invest led Medvedev, by the way, when I was in Moscow, the headlines were filled with Medvedev telling these oligarchs, you better be patriotic, start reinvesting in this country. You have a moral debt to this country and society. Stop being greedy. Now, that's talk. On the one hand, so you have the oligarchs' raw selfishness, and then you have an administration, a regime, which did fail to diversify because, like other oil countries, you know the bane and the curse of oil can be that it seems so sweet. Why take the hard work, the steps to diversify? That is now a real problem. Though Russia is probably, on, you know, again, I'm not an economist, but it's certainly in stronger shape than Ukraine, for example, which, mm-hmm. I mean, is in total economic and political collapse. Your listeners may remember seeing tent cities in Ukraine a few years ago to promote an orange revolution, as it was called, the democratization of Ukraine. Well, they're tent cities now in the squares of Kiev, the capital, but they're demanding the government do something. They're protesting the economic failures of this divided government. And again, Eastern Europe was very exposed to over leverage, and that has not affected Russia in ways that we see in other countries.
This is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. Our guest today, Katrina Vandenhoevel, joining us from New York on the phone. Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor of The Nation, and you can go see about The Nation at thenation.com. Katrina, we've only got a few minutes left, and one of the issues you've written about recently that is, I think, an issue that gets neglected, but it's coming to the fore again, is the state of the criminal justice system in the United States. Maybe talk a little bit about the piece you wrote, what Jim Webb's doing.
Yeah, but if I could, I'd like to just say that there is some good news out of New York on that front, Bob.
Oh, good.
Your listeners, yeah, may not know. I mean, the Rockefeller drug laws, draconian laws passed over 35 years ago, which established tough mandatory sentences with no judicial discretion for the sale or possession of small, relatively small amounts of drugs, proven over these last years not only to be a failure, wasteful, ineffective, unjust, also racially biased. The consequence of having the three top political leaders in New York State, the governor, the assembly speaker, and the Senate majority leader, allied with the financial crisis in the state, a $15 billion budget deficit, have led to the stars being aligned. And I think we're going to see, and the New York Times reported this late last yesterday, because, the other day, the nation's been on this for a period of time, that we're going to see a repeal, if not a repeal, significant reforms of drug laws that have led to the crowding, terrible crowding of New York State jails, and have been, as I said, not only ineffective and wasteful, but racially unjust and biased. So the hope here is that it will be a model. And I think Senator Webb's legislation and introduction of legislation to look at the failures of our criminal justice system may look at New York State and what happens here as a model of alternatives to incarceration and how valuable that could be in ending the fact that, you know, if America's number one right now, Bob, it's in our prison population, which is not what we want in terms of sending a signal to the world.
No, in fact, if I'm not mistaken, we hold something like 25% of the world's prisoners.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, and you know, so I think we are number one.
Yeah, with a bullet.
But the key here will be taking advantage of, again, I talked earlier about how the crisis also provides opportunities. You know, there may not be a moral, fundamental, radical rethink of the criminal justice system, but there is an effective, pragmatic one that needs to be taken, and the crisis is pushing people across this country to do that in various states, to think of ways, alternatives to prison. The key will be, and I think this is where something progressives can be involved with, and maybe Webb's commission will bring light, shed light on this, is when New York deinstitutionalized the mentally ill many years ago, I think it was in the 70s, forgive me if I don't remember exactly, but there was a sense that that was a progressive reform because these institutions which housed the mentally ill were brutal and not effective. But then the people went into the communities, deinstitutionalized, and the funding wasn't there to provide the adequate networks and support. The hope now is that there will be funding for drug treatment programs, so that there is a success out of this and not lead to some kind of backlash. And I just want to say one thing. I've been involved for a few years with a group called, many years, with a group called the Correctional Association. It's a group in New York, the only group in the country which has a mandate from the state legislature given in, I think, 1844 to visit prisons, to report on the condition in prisons. It has been part of a very good coalition. And as I said earlier, so much change comes from citizen mobilization, but a coalition called Drop the Rock, mm-hmm. which began 10 years ago, and that coalition is also part of the reason we're going to see reform and repeal. It's not just the fact, though very helpful, that the top three political leaders in New York State support reform and repeal.
Well, it's striking, too, that a senator like Jim Webb, who is hardly has a career that associates him with the ACLU or prison rights, has become such a strong proponent of really trimming back the prison industrial complex.
Well, I think he's a perfect messenger for this message because, I mean, it's, not to be glib, but if your listeners remember that Nixon goes to China, you had this fierce anti-communist who then opened up U.S. relations with China. But it's interesting, Webb is a very interesting figure. We want to do more on him, but he's a writer as well. And as a journalist, I write about how he visited Japan and Japanese prisons, and he saw there the need for a different kind of U.S. criminal justice system. Again, if one is open-minded, you can learn from other nations and that there are other ways of doing things, and that's a valuable lesson that he seems willing to pass on.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, our guest today, we only have a few minutes left. Katrina, one issue I do want to touch on because it is so central to the economy and to the welfare of lives of Americans is the Employee Free Choice Act, the law that would make it easier for workers to organize trade unions, similar to how it was in the late 30s and 40s until the Taft-Hartley Act. And this was a something that President Obama committed to as a candidate. It was crucial to getting massive labor support for his candidacy in the campaign. Where do you think it stands now?
Not in a good place. I hate to say that because I think, as you do, Bob, that the Employee Free Choice Act is not only a step to level the playing field, to rebuild a middle class, to crucial also, by the way, to raise wages and raise demand at a time of recession, but politically with Specter, the senator from Pennsylvania, saying he would not support the Employee Free Choice Act. I think, you know, with the filibuster issue, with the need for 60, you're going to have a hard time. I think labor is going to have to think hard about how it wants to push this and how much of a priority, which it was obviously for them in supporting Democratic candidate Obama, how hard they're going to push to make sure it is on the agenda. Now, the other thing I'd say is, you know, you want to push, but you also, you know, want to build in what, with Hilda Solis, a good labor secretary, build in while one pushes for the Employee Free Choice Act, the rebuilding of the National Labor Relations Board, rebuilding of real policing of wage violations, policing of labor abuses, all of these things that were not only neglected, were battered, were decimated under a Bush administration. So that needs to go on parallel to the fight that we can't give up on, but maybe tough in this term, this year, the Employee Free Choice Act.
What would you say the Obama administration has done so far that you've been most pleased with? What have they done that's really made you glad that the nation threw its support to Obama?
I think coming back to labor, we haven't seen maybe the political capital expended yet, but I thought when Barack Obama talks about labor as part of the problem, not, you know, labor rights as part of the solution, not the problem. But I think, and these are not small things, Bob, but I think a restoration of the understanding of scientific integrity, a real commitment to greening our economy, to rebuilding a new infrastructure built around green jobs and environmental sustainability. I think the repeal of the global gag rule, your listeners may not know it, but, you know, allowing family planning funding to organizations which are involved in reproductive rights, a commitment to women and children, to funding programs for women and children. But it's the greening piece of it, I think, has been a real commitment. I'm interested they brought in Van Jones, someone your listeners may know, very charismatic African-American man who came out of the Ella Baker Human Rights Center in Oakland and has a commitment to making sure that a sustainable green infrastructure is built with a diversity, with a sustainability, and with jobs. The pull out of Iraq could have been quicker. We need to push to make sure it is real, that they don't leave 50,000 forces behind, that contractors are out. So there's no silver bullet here in terms of, wow, everything we wanted. But I do think that there has been a commitment to some core principles, but we have a lot of work ahead of us.
One thing
I would say is, people, our readers, know that it's not like the Clinton years, which for some crazy reason a lot of people thought, hey, everything's solved. There's an engagement that is ongoing, and we see it in our circulation and in our readership, which knows they need to keep pushing.
Our guest today has been Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor of The Nation magazine. If you're not a subscriber, you can learn about The Nation at thenation.com. It's a website that's updated constantly. Katrina VandenHeuvel, thank you so much for joining us today in Media Matters.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure having you. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer. Next week, 167 hours from now, I'll be back with Amy Goodman. My name's Bob McChesney. Everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, cloudy with periods of rain and thunderstorms today, the high of 55 degrees. Tonight, cloudy, windy, and turning colder with rain showers changing to snow showers, the low around 30. Tomorrow, cloudy, windy, and cold with occasional light snow, a high of 38. And tomorrow night, cloudy, breezy, and cold with occasional snow and a low of 24. This is WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, a broadcast service of the College of Media at Illinois.
From PR.